talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead, make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning. Today is March 28th, and this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And we weren't here last week, although you may have enjoyed our best of show. I forget when I made that. Did you hear that? I forgot to render it with our intro that we had recorded. I don't know why I forgot that.
I did hear it.
But we are back live in the studio today. Michelle was in, where were you, in Texas or something?
I was in Texas for the week.
Having a chainsaw massacre?
It was lovely. Yeah, how'd you know?
It was good. And I was in North Carolina. Jim was here, but he didn't want to do a solo show.
That's right. Well, I was in fabulous, beautiful Benton, Illinois for a few days.
There you go. Well, we've got a lot to talk about because there was a big weekend. You know what? Batman versus Superman got really bad reviews, so it probably tanked at the box office, I would assume. Why would anybody go see a movie that's only at 29 on the Rotten Tomatoes scale?
Did it even make the top 10? I don't know.
It did. From comscore.com, here is the top 12 domestic weekend box office estimates. At number one is Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. Warner Brothers film brought in $170.1 million for the weekend. Warner Brothers Pictures Adventure had a winning opening weekend, earning an estimated worldwide box office total of $424.1 million, the top superhero movie opening of all time and the fourth biggest industry opening of all time. It's breaking numerous records domestically and internationally.
Now, also down to hit all the major international markets, like we're not going to hear in a couple of weeks, it's finally opening in China or Japan or something. It opened everywhere.
The highly anticipated big screen superhero battle earned, like I said, $170.1 million at the domestic box office, with the widest pre-May release at 4,242 locations, and at $27.7 million, the biggest Easter Thursday pre-show opening. 4,242. With the film opening day and date in 66 markets outside the U.S., the international box office take was an estimated $254 million over the weekend, on an unprecedented 40,000 screens.
That's a record now.
It was breaking all sorts of records. It marks Warner Brothers' biggest opening of all time in China, Mexico, and Brazil. And it's the second largest overseas opening for Warner Brothers after the final Harry Potter film. Both domestically and internationally, the film enjoyed the biggest March opening ever, the industry's biggest opening of 2016, the biggest Easter weekend opening, the top opening of all time for DC Comics film, and the highest opening for a Zack Snyder-directed film, Ben Affleck film, and a Henry Cavill film. Globally, it broke the IMAX opening record for Easter weekend with a worldwide gross of $36 million, a 945 IMAX screen.
So it did well. Despite its poor reviews.
This is kind of a Teflon.
It's like people weren't listening to the critics. I don't believe that.
No.
Yeah, even Michael Heffner at our side gave it a miserly, 2 out of 5, I think?
Yeah, he was a big fan of Man of Steel. So.
Right. We're going to be looking forward to see what it does next weekend and how far it drops off.
What
but there's
opens
nothing.
Nothing.
So I think they gave it a 2-week berth, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, my goodness. Although there was, I think at number 3 there's a film that opened the same day. So.
At number 2 is Disney's Zootopia with $23.1 million. The animated family film has a domestic total of $240.5 million. Universal Pictures' My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 was number 3. Fans of the 2002 comedy brought the sequel. It's 18.1 million take this weekend. The original film saw an Oscar nomination for original screenplay for its writer Nia Vardalos.
Jim reviewed My Big Fat Greek. And we're going to review it, actually. Here. Jim didn't like it.
Yeah. That's, to say the least.
18's not too bad.
No, that's pretty respectable if it hadn't have been for the behemoth at number 1.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It probably didn't cost that much to me.
No, if you talk to fans of the original, they were going in droves. So at number 4 was the Divergent series Allegiant with 9.5 million.
I saw that in North Carolina with my 12-year-old daughter, and she assured me that it was the last in the series because I didn't want to see it. She goes, "Oh, Dad, it's the last one in the series. You can sit through this." So it ends on a cliffhanger. It's not the last one in the series.
No, I think they're going to do another one.
They still have.
Into 2, probably. Mm-hmm.
I was not happy.
Allegiance total now stands at $118.4 million worldwide. It's doing much better overseas, which is good news for Lionsgate. Miracles from Heaven was number 5 with $9.5 million. The faith-based film has a box office total of $34
million. That's pretty good. Probably had to do with my positive review over where you're moving.
That has to be it. At number 6 is Paramount Pictures' 10 Cloverfield Lane with $6 million. The Alien Invasion film has done well with audiences and looks to have an estimated new total here in the U.S. of $56 million.
Well, that's another low-budget one, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So that's made its money back.
You know, and I'm sure Paramount Pictures is going to want another one in the Cloverfield universe.
Well, they'll just want to give J.J. whatever he wants to do.
To keep him happy. And Deadpool landed in the number 7 spot. 20th Century Fox's R-rated superhero movie starring Ryan Reynolds added another $5 million to its already massive $349 million total. Focus Features London Has Fallen came in at number 8 with $2.9
million. I saw that in North Carolina as well. I took my 85-year-old father who enjoys action films. I don't think he'd ever seen a disaster porn before. He's like, how did they destroy London like that? He was very confused. But he enjoyed it. And my 12-year-old daughter, she tagged along to the R-rated movie, and she enjoyed it as well.
Good. The Gerard Butler sequel to Olympus Has Fallen has a new global total of $110 million. Hello, my name is Doris, was number 9 at this weekend's box office. Roadside Attractions film starring Oscar winner Sally Field took in an estimated $1.7
million. Well, good. Maybe it'll expand so that my mother can see it. Uh-huh. She's wanting to see it.
So. Yeah. I hope so, too. At number 10 was Eye in the Sky, starring Helen Mirren and the late Alan Rickman. Bleecker Street's engaging film saw an estimated $1 million over the holiday weekend. Sony's Risen was number 11 with $0.9 million. The Christian-based film has a domestic total of $36
million. I'm surprised to see Young Messiah has dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wasn't that supposed to be like the movie everybody saw over Easter weekend?
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yeah, it didn't.
I mean,
it
opened after Risen, but Risen is still in the top 12. Yeah,
I couldn't even find it anywhere in their charts.
Yeah, Risen's at least a month old, isn't it?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. weird.
And in its third week of release, Tina Fey's Whiskey Tango Foxtrot was number 12 at the box office. Paramount Pictures movie brought in an estimated $0.9 million. So that's it for the holiday weekend box office.
We've got a few movies to review this week. Jim saw My Big Fat Greek Wedding Part 2.
A long time ago, I had a big, fat Greek wedding. Now my daughter is all grown up.
Hope you applied to some local colleges, too.
Why do parents always say dream big when they really mean not too big?
Ian and I are just trying to find a minute to ourselves.
How about another date tonight?
And afterward, oh, satin, slippery like an eel.
Leah!
You're welcome. Shave everything.
Yes,
and
I did.
What'd you give it? 1.5 out of 5 stars?
Yeah, something like that. You know,
right.
it's just, you know.
You're the only one in the room that's seen it, so let's hear it.
Well, you know, I had not seen the original until a couple of days before seeing the sequel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
did you see the original?
Well, I was when I was in Benton, Illinois. My mother has all the premium channels, so ran on one of them. So I DVR'd it and watched it Saturday afternoon before I saw it Monday night.
Did you like the original better than the second one?
I felt about the same about both. You know, I just kind of. You know, just cutesy stuff. Oh, look at the adorable foreigners. You know, they're so sweet and all that. And it just, I don't know, it just kind of grated on me after a while. It just... I don't know.
So what's the premise of this? What's the premise of this sequel?
Well, of course, it's I guess it's about 12 years since the original, and the little daughter that you saw at the end of that, now she's a teenager, and it's odd. It's like they didn't quite know, you know, how to portray her. She's got this goth makeup, but she's dressing like she's going to a grunge concert, and they just couldn't quite figure it out. And of course, she's exasperated, yelling, "Mother, Mom!" And you know, she's embarrassed by Mom and all that. Yeah. Now, Mom herself, Nia Vardalos' Tula, she's back working at the restaurant, back at Dancing Zorba's, because in that first film, she was working at a travel agency, and what's happened to those places? So she's back there. It's an interesting kind of switch. This is probably the only really original thing, because from the trailers and the poster, you're thinking it's going to be about the upcoming wedding of the daughter of Tula and Ian. But no, Gus, who's played by Michael Constantine.
Michael Constantine's 90 years old, by the way.
I know.
Remember when he was like, wasn't he principal on like Room
Principal
222?
Kaufman on Room 222.
That was like 50 years ago.
yeah. So Mr. Kaufman is searching for his roots. He's determined to prove to everyone that he's a direct descendant of Alexander the Great. And he's going through his stuff, and it turns out that his wedding license was never signed, that the priest that married them really couldn't have married them, and so he's kind of been living in sin, shacking up with Maria, who's played by Lainey Kazan.
Oh, wow, what a wacky plot twist to get the plot rolling.
Yeah, so that they can get another big Greek wedding going.
Oh,
And it's, of course, Andrea Martin's Aunt Viola, or Viola. She's puts herself in charge, and she's brassy and, you know, telling people way too much about her bodily functions. And, you know, they got, you got the Windex gags. They've got a new gag in this one, like where they say, you know, squeeze my neck so that when they take a selfie, that squeezing your neck can take out all the wrinkles. Although I hate to get into this, but I believe that some of the cast members had some stuff done, so it's a little tough to make out their facial expressions and, you know, what their emotions
including
are.
Including the lead?
I'm not going to say, but there are several that that look like that has been, that's been done, and you're like, come on, that really hinders you as an actress.
Yeah. So what was so bad about this movie?
It's just it's just so cutesy and, you know, sweet, and you can kind of tell where things are going, and I feel bad for John Corbett in it because he's kind of the straight man again.
Who wrote the script? Did Nia Vardalos write the script again?
She wrote this one. This had a different director. I think Kirk Jones was the director on this one, who's directed some British films prior to this. I think the original director was Joel Zwick, so he knew to bail this time out. Yeah. You know, there's they have all the relatives acting crazy and wild, and they have a couple of unnecessary cameos. There's a new couple that's moved into the neighborhood, played by co-producer Rita Wilson and John Stamos. Really, because he's like the most famous Greek actor out there, right? I guess.
And we've all been dying to see John Stamos back on the big screen.
Well, he doesn't eat any yogurt in this one, but he's in there looking handsome and tan. He's supposed to be a TV, local TV news guy. And their subplot goes nowhere. I think I mentioned in my review, they absolutely waste the great Rob Riggle in a cameo role in this this unbearable scene of college. Well, that's the deal. Tulanian's daughter Paris is deciding where to go to college, and Rob Riggle's character is representing Northwestern University. Of course, they want her to go there because Northwestern is right next to Chicago, and that's where the film is set. So they want her to stay at home and go to college. And you know, he doesn't really have anything funny to do in it, and he's a really funny guy. Mm-hmm. But so I was kind of frustrated with that. Right. So it just really, really just ultra, just too sweet. And I mentioned that it felt like it was several episodes of a sitcom stitched together. It just was going from one little funny thing to another. It was very odd.
Sounds pretty bad. So Jim does not recommend My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. Jim also saw the Hank Williams story, which is called I Saw the Light.
Let's give a rousing welcome to Mr. Hank Williams. All right, boys, let it roll.
When he first came to see me, he played some songs he'd written, and I offered him a contract right then and there.
Cooking something up with me.
Most of the time, I do.
Said, hey, sweet baby.
Congratulations. You have a son, Mr. Williams.
He's going to have a real day. Not like it was for me.
It's a brand new rest.
Stars out. Tom Hiddleston?
Hiddleston.
Hiddleston. What did I call him?
H-I-H-I-D.
I guess I got him mixed up with...
Middlematch.
What was the guy from Blazing Saddles? David Hiddleston?
Yeah, David Hiddleston.
That's who I was thinking.
Yes.
Now, they made a Hank Williams Jr. or Hank Williams Sr. story in 1964, and that was called Your Cheating Heart with George Hamilton.
Was Susan Oliver in that one?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And actually, Hank Williams Jr. dubbed the songs that his father was singing in that film.
Right.
I believe Hiddleston sings his own tunes.
He does, and I thought he's just terrific when he's up there singing.
But I bet he doesn't have as good a tan as George Hamilton.
That's true. Although he's a lot thinner and a lot more, it looks like he's wasting away more than George Hamilton. Yeah. And George Hamilton looked like he came right from the beach.
So you say Hiddleston is good. Is the movie good?
He's the only reason to see it, really. When he's on stage performing, it's very interesting, very entertaining. But the movie clocks in at a very long 2 hours. Okay. It concentrates on Hank's life from around 1944 until his untimely death, I believe, in 50. By that time, he's pretty much already in the bottle. Most of the film is just kind of watching him just, you know, drink himself to death.
Mm-hmm. So they go into his death.
Yeah, they go into it quite a bit. Quite a bit. Go into his problems with his womanizing. When he starts, the film starts out with him marrying his wife Audrey, who is played by the beautiful Elizabeth Olsen, who we might know better as the Scarlet Witch from Avengers: Age of Ultron and the upcoming Civil War. And she's kind of an aspiring singer too. Audrey is, and she goes up and on stage to sing with him at the honky tonks, and she's doesn't really have it. His band knows that, and the fellow that owns the radio station where Hank has an early morning radio show kind of knows that, and so she's frustrated about that. She thinks she's just as talented. Plus, she's clashing with Hank's manager mother, played by Cherry Jones, in a very good performance. Hank's big thing is he wants to break out of this morning radio show and the little honky tonk bars and get on the Grand Ole Opry, but it seems like there's all these sort of barriers thrown up in his path. And until finally, when his songs are so popular and it's getting so much airplay on different stations that they have to invite him on there, and he almost blows it by coming in late and inebriated and all that. And you know, it just kind of goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Finally, he and Audrey separate and divorce after several, you know, different attempts, breakups, and all that, and lots of philandering by Hank. And at the end of it, he's juggling these two different women and still, you know, boozing it up as much as possible. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of a shame to see such a great performance, you know, wasting kind of a mediocre script.
I don't think this movie's going to go anywhere.
No. I think it's only opening in a couple of places here in a week or so.
Well,
it's
telling is when Tony Classics moved it out of award season. Yeah. Just kind of dumped it here.
It's directed and written. It's adapted from a book about Hank, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, written and directed by Mark Abrahams, who his last film was Flash of Genius, I believe. Mm-hmm. The film with Greg Kinnear as the inventor
of the seatbelt.
The windshield wipers. Yes.
I never saw that.
So no, you know, if you're a fan of those actors, I recommend it. Bradley Whitford is in it, very good as one of the record company execs that sort of becomes Hank's agent. I think his name is Rose. He's very good, but and you know, the location stuff is great. The mm-hmm. old cars and the fashions are terrific. It just kind of spins its wheels. The mm-hmm. plot does, and it's just going
That's
from one, you know, one outburst and one, you know, booze filled night to the next, mm-hmm. and it gets kind of repetitive.
All right, so Jim doesn't really recommend the Hank Williams story, which is called "I Saw the Light." Okay, we cannot put it off any longer. It's time to review Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice.
We have to take it as an absolute certainty.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night.
You're psychotic.
That is a three-syllable word for any thought too big for little minds.
Which opened over the weekend to a massive $170 billion. And Michael Havner reviewed it for Weird Movie Geeks and gave it 2 out of 5 stars. I thought that was much lower than I would have given it. I'd probably have given it maybe 3.5.
I might give it 3. I was surprised because Michael was such a huge supporter of Man of Steel, which lots of us had problems with.
Yeah.
And but... And lots of true Superman fans had problems with. I remember at the advanced screening of Man of Steel, there was a fellow screaming about it at the end of it. You know, actually, you know, with expletives and everything.
How many stars would you have given it? Had you reviewed it, Michelle?
4.
Michelle would have given it 4. I would have given it 3.5. Jim would have given it 3, and Michael gave it 2.
Yeah.
So we're all over the map over here at WeirdMovieGeeks.com. I didn't think it was really any worse than the Chris Nolan, Christian Bale trilogy of Batman films. In fact, I think Ben Affleck was probably a better Batman than Mr. Bale, in my opinion.
Did you see a
just him in a Batman.
Yeah, movie. Just simplify.
Yeah, they need to. They need to have a solo Batman film. I know we'll get to see him in Suicide Squad here in a few months. But I'm guessing that's probably just one scene, maybe about five minutes or something.
And like,
Affleck was Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy Irons is a terrific Alfred.
I wish they would have used him a little bit more.
Me too.
Yeah. As I understand, they shot footage of Jenna Malone as Barbara Gordon, which we'll see in the R-rated extended cut that's going to come out on Blu-ray, I'm sure.
Really?
But those are the only real representatives of Gotham City in there. It's mostly concentrated on Metropolis.
Now, Barbara Gordon as Batgirl or just Barbara Gordon as Commissioner Gordon's daughter?
I'm guessing just as Barbara Gordon. But I'm wondering if it's going to be the post. Well, here's a little comic, little geek thing there. I wonder if it's post Killing Joke. The Killing Joke is the celebrated graphic novel in which the Joker pretty much crippled Barbara Gordon and sent Batman on a spree to try to find him. And then that turned Barbara Gordon into the character Oracle, who was a computer whiz and guided everybody. But that's getting too geeky, I guess.
You're confusing me.
Yes.
The highlight for me, though, was Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. So excited the way that she made her entrance.
Yeah.
I can't wait for her solo standalone movie. The way she just comes in and just...
Yeah, I was going to say that I don't know if the scenes prior to that with her Bruce Wayne work as well. There's kind of a little flirtation going.
Yeah,
so we're just kind of counting down and wondering, when are you going to... when are you going to, get those bracelets on? Get the sword.
She shows up for the big battle scene.
Yeah, but
fantastic.
But unfortunately, we get to see her in action in a couple of sequences. Most of the time, Zack Snyder is shooting this so dark with the big lens flares the action is so frenetic at some points when he's not slowing down and going into slow motion. It's so frenetic, you just see little flashes of her being dragged by her golden lasso. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem with the filmmaking of that whole sequence.
And who was that monster? Doomsday? Is he from the comic
books? He is from the comic books. He is from the Death of Superman story arc from the early 90s in which Superman was killed at the hands of Doomsday.
I remember that. And then the comic book came in like a black plastic bag.
Yes, and everyone bought a copy because it was going to be a collectible. And it's it's not a collectible if everybody buys it and keeps it in the shrink wrap.
That was such a scam.
Yeah, so you can get it for like a buck now.
Did Doomsday look like that in the comic book?
Pretty much, but he kind of looked closer to one of the giant trolls from Lord of the Rings.
That was a worthless villain. In fact, that was the biggest weakness of this film that I saw Saturday night was the villain, especially Jesse Eisenberg.
Well, as I say, he's better than Eisenberg. Eisenberg is just... he's the sinkhole at the center of this film.
And his performance is so busy and so fussy.
Now, I'm not going to... Jesse Eisenberg is a good actor. It's a badly written character. A friend of mine I talked to this weekend out in California, who was a huge Man of Steel fan, a huge Batman fan, he said, boy, that film is just a mess.
Yeah.
The script is just all over the place. And I guess they figured they couldn't have the Joker in this film, so let's Joker up Lex Luthor.
Yeah, they tried to give him some of the same sort of maniacal energy that Joker had, and it just did not work. And Lex Luthor, I've said this before, has always been kind of a lame villain anyway. Why didn't they bring one of the Batman villains in and make him... Batman has more colorful villains. Why didn't they bring one of the Batman villains in and make him the central villain?
Well, I don't know. I'd say Lex Luthor is definitely the best of the Superman villains, along with Brainiac. Maybe Brainiac would have worked
better. Mr. Mixel Pixel is my favorite. they never brought him to
the prankster
big screen. Now, what I heard, wasn't Bryan Cranston one time in talks to play
there Luther? Was some rumors about
him. He would have been much, much better.
Well, I don't think he would have been as twitchy. I mean, my goodness, even in that opening, our introduction to Lex Luthor, when he's speaking at this charity function, he's doing all these little ticks and twitches and loses it by the end of the speech and delves into this Norman Bates stuff.
It is very distracting. I will...
Yeah.
You know, and that's the roughest part of the film. That and the constant, not flashbacks, but nightmare sequences of Bruce Wayne. And people were complaining about a new Spider-Man. It's like, how many times are we going to get to see Uncle Ben get killed? Well, not as many as the Waynes, that's for sure, because we get to see that again first 5 minutes.
However, and you and I and Max Foisy, our friend over at 97.1, we're talking about the great cameos that showed up for Justice League we got to see.
But the way that they're presented, it's in an email.
But still,
or somebody online called it a Lex mail.
Yeah, but I loved how we got to meet, you know, Aquaman and Flash.
I thought it was kind of clever the way they integrated those into
because you got to have the tie-ins. And I also appreciate what Zack Snyder did with, like I said before, Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman and Amy Adams' Lois Lane. So I like, you know, maybe they could have been a little bit stronger, but I did like what he did.
It was really humorless, too, which I think was a problem. There was one line where when he saves Diane Lane and he says, "It's okay, I'm a friend of your son's." And everybody busted out laughing. But that line was kind of out of place because it was the only attempt at humor in the whole thing. It was kind of like in Superman, Man of Steel, where there was a line where she first meets Clark Kent and Lois Lane says, "Oh, you can carry my suitcase, but be careful, they're heavy." And everybody laughed at that. And that was a cute line. But that was the only funny line in that movie.
Well, let's
either put in a dozen funny lines or don't put in any funny lines.
Well, Lawrence Fishburne had some funny lines in this. I enjoyed him, you know, yelling at Clark. He says, "Yeah, this newspaper isn't the same one that it was when it started in 1938," and which is a great, you know, callback.
Yeah,
to the first
that was
issue
more
of
a.
But no,
he's more of an Easter egg than a funny line.
Well, then he's telling, you know, Lois Lane, "No, you're flying coach, flying economy coach." When she's going off for something, but there's more for Lois to do in this one than in Man of Steel.
That's what I liked about Amy Adams.
But I still don't think there's any chemistry between her and Henry Cavill. I mean, they try to kind of, you know, sex things up with a bathtub scene, which seemed
kind of desperate to me.
I also did like the score from Hans Zimmer, Junkie XL. I think it could have been a little bit stronger, but it was still.
I think it could have been a little quieter.
No,
it's
we liked it. It was really loud.
Yeah. And
it was all over the map, too.
And the last 10 minutes is just a big setup for Justice League. And I know that Marvel took a lot of heat for some of the setup stuff in Age of Ultron, but this is way more hitting you over the head. You know, way more intense than that. You know, yeah, I wanted to like it, but more because I like Ben Affleck as Batman and as Bruce Wayne. I think he's terrific. You remember all the heat he was getting on the internet?
I don't know why.
The minute Warner Brothers announced that, it was just a firestorm.
And he's very good. He has that sort of haunted look about him when he's Bruce Wayne, even though he does have a couple of funny lines at the start of it.
Yeah.
And the whole interaction between him and Jeremy Irons is just terrific.
More of that. Definitely wanted more of that.
But the thing was just overstuffed, which is kind of what I expected. It was overly dark. It was overly
way too dark as usual. I mean, you know, I just have a tough time accepting that Metropolis and Gotham City are just across the bay from each other.
I couldn't even figure that out.
Yeah, I always assumed that, you know, that Metropolis was New York City and Gotham City was Chicago and growing up reading the books, you know.
So are you still looking forward to Suicide Squad?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, you know, I'll see it. Yeah.
I saw a trailer for it. I guess a new trailer.
I mean, you know, I'm looking forward to Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
But, we'll see if it's
Will Smith play in that?
He plays Deadshot.
Deadshot.
Super assassin.
Was he in another film, Deadshot?
I don't believe so.
Or is this his big film debut?
I think he was a character on the Arrow TV show.
Oh, okay. But is Mr. Mixelpixel going to be in?
No, you're going to have to wait for that, I guess.
That'll be in the next Superman movie.
Yeah, maybe Kevin Hart could play Mr. Mixelpixel.
There you go.
He's about the right size, I guess.
Yeah. Now that Dudley Moore is gone.
That's right.
All right, anybody else want to say anything else about Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice?
Well, I'm wondering, Tom, did you see it in 3D?
I did see it in 3D. I took my 85-year-old Alzheimer's-addled mother-in-law, and she refused to wear her 3D glasses. I go, "It's going to be blurry if you're not wearing your 3D glasses." She goes, "I think it looks better this way." She's very stubborn. So she sat there for the whole 2.5 hours without her 3D glasses on.
Well, Michelle and I saw it in 2D, and I remarked after it, must just look horrible in 3D because it's so...
You gotta have bright scenes for 3D to work right, and then, you know, 90% of this movie is in the dark. So no, the 3D was a non-starter. It didn't add a bit. It didn't hurt it, but it certainly didn't add anything.
I mean, it's even overcast in Metropolis all the time, and I thought that would be the main difference. I mean, in one scene that's sort of unintentionally funny, it's just raining in Gotham City.
Yeah.
In Metropolis, the skies are clear. You know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just had a lot of problems with that script. They really got to step up their game if they're going to catch up to Marvel, guys. Come on.
But apparently audiences didn't care about our bad reviews. It made $170 million.
Actually, the new numbers are in. It's $166
million. Oh, so not so impressive.
So, yeah, it's going to have legs in order to turn a profit. I mean, it cost, I've heard, upwards of $250 million. And all the money's on screen there. But, yeah, they're going to have to clear in excess of $800 million to turn any sort of profit.
So we sort of are all over the map on this movie. All right, let's see. Let's talk about a few things going on locally. We're going to talk a little bit more about Batman and Superman a little bit later, but let's talk about some stuff going on in town. Actually, this week there's not a whole lot going on, but next week all kinds of stuff is going on. I got my 16mm double feature night next Tuesday night at the Way Out Club. Way Out Club is at 2525 Jefferson at the corner of Gravois and Jefferson. I'm showing a 16mm prints of Dirty Harry, starring Clint Eastwood, and The Mighty Peking Man, starring the beautiful Evelyn Craft. And next Monday, I will announce what my May show will be. So that's 8 o'clock, and it's free, although we do set out a jar for the National Children's Cancer Society. 100% of the money that ends up in that jar will be handed over to the good folks at that charity. Our friends Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra. These guys are great. This is a local group of very talented musicians who write original scores for famous silent films and perform them. I just saw them last Saturday. They performed for The Passion of Joan of Arc.
It was a nice performance.
It was fantastic. Yeah. And they are playing again next Saturday, which is the 9th, I believe, at a movie theater in New Haven, Missouri. And I don't have the name of the theater. I would be putting an article up this week at WeAreMovieGeeks.com with more details. Shucks, I should know the name of that theater, but that is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at this. It's kind of fun to go to these small towns and see some of these old sort of restored movie theaters. I was in DeSoto, Missouri last weekend to see a Marianne from Gilligan's Island, and that was at this little theater. But it's really charming. They take a lot of pride in their little neighborhood theaters in some of these small towns, which is nice. And I get the feeling this one in New Haven.
Well, about how far is that about from St.
New
Louis?
Haven is about 60 miles west of St. Louis.
So it's a nice little drive.
And DeSoto was about 60 miles south. So. Yeah, it's not too bad. You probably get there in about an hour and a half. Yeah. So, again, the movie that they're playing, though, is Buster Keaton in Go West, which I've never seen. Have you seen that one, Jim?
I saw that when Webster presented it a few years ago during their Buster Keaton Festival.
Did it have live music?
I believe it had a fellow at the piano for that one, not the full orchestra.
Well, I think this is the first film that Rats and People ever wrote a score for, so they have done it before. Yeah, and they're young guys, so it has to have been within the past, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. But next weekend, which would be the 8th and 9th, the Midnight Series at the Tivoli, Real Late at the Tivoli, kicks off with Rocky Horror Picture Show. Mm-hmm. That'll be Friday and Saturday night, and they've got this group called the Samurai Electricians that come out and act out Rocky Horror Picture Show on stage.
It's interesting. Don't they usually conclude the Real 8 series with Rocky Horror?
The past couple of years, they've been starting the series in April with Rocky Horror and ending it in October with Rocky Horror because it always sells out. It's a cash cow, I guess, for the people over there at the Tivoli. It cost like $600 for the licensing for Rocky Horror. But they always sell out, so they always make plenty of money.
Oh, yeah.
I usually host the midnight show at the Tivoli, but I don't when they do Rocky Horror Picture Show because they have their own crazy crew wearing bustiers and fishnet stockings. And sometimes women get dressed up, too. So.
Well, I was going to say, Tom, I know you have that.
I do. I'll probably be there giving away a swag out in the street because people show up at like 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock and just it becomes kind of a street party as they stand in line. So I get some great pictures and I will be putting those up at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. But then I'm going to head over to the Moolah.
Oh, yeah.
Destroy the Brain is where they have moved their late night grindhouse. Last week we saw, Video Drone. That was a lot of fun. This week, or next week,
I'm
I should
say.
Very
comfortable.
Yeah.
Maybe too comfortable.
Yeah, I heard you snoring over there, Michelle.
I did.
But this week is going to be a great one. I'm really excited about Rolling Thunder. That is the film they are showing at midnight on the 8th and 9th. That stars William Devane and Tommy Lee Jones.
A scene-stealing Tommy Lee Jones. He's terrific in it.
Yeah, Linda Haynes is the blonde female lead. It's a terrific movie.
Yeah,
it's,
Lucas Skew and James Best.
Yeah, they're the bad guys. It was Paul Schrader's, he wrote it. He didn't direct it. John Flynn directed it, but it was his follow-up to Taxi. I guess that's it for local stuff. I'm sure we'll have more stuff to talk about next week. Like we said, Batman vs. Superman made $170 million, and we like Batman, and we like Superman. We just didn't really like this new movie as much as we hoped we would. But Batman and Superman adventures on the big screen have been going on since, the 1940s, early 1940s, right, Jim?
Yeah, actually, the first of the two characters to hit the big screen was Superman, but in animated form in 1941.
Up in the sky, look!
It's a bird!
It's a plane! It's Superman!
Series of 17 shorts produced first by the Fleischer brothers, then taken over by Paramount's Famous Studios.
Yeah.
And they brought over Bud Collier and Jonah Alexander from the radio show to do the voices of Clark Kent, Lois Lane. And
did they have some of the villains from the Superman comic books?
No, although they came close in the very first animated short, which is called The Mad Scientist, sometimes just called Superman, was nominated for an Oscar for Best Short. There's a character that kind of like Lex Luthor was there, the mad, you know, super scientist sort of thing. But the first one to be portrayed in live action in the movies is Batman in the 1943 15-chapter serial from Columbia Pictures. It starred Lewis Wilson as Bruce Wayne Batman, and Douglas Croft as Robin, Dick Grayson. And actually, Douglas Croft plays young Jimmy Cagney in Yankee Doodle Dandy. Found that out recently. And it was interesting that they don't face off against one of the comic book villains in that
either. But the comic book villains had been invented by then.
Oh, yeah. The Joker was certainly going strong then. The Catwoman was.
But they brought in, J. Carroll Nash as Dr. Daka?
Yeah. This was...
He was a
Japanese Axis agent.
He was the Yellow Menace.
Yes. And Batman and Robin are fully sanctioned by the U.S. government. They're special agents, and they're assigned to go find Dr. Daka, who's assembling different scientists and trying to get uranium.
But why do you think they did not bring in the Joker or the Penguin?
They just thought it was going to be enough for audiences to accept a guy dressed up as a bat fighting crime. It would just be something that they couldn't comprehend, a guy, made up like a clown going after them.
And also, that was right in the middle of World War II when we were fighting the Japs, and I guess they wanted to do everything they could do possible to make a...
Interesting is a year later, Captain America came to the serials, but he wasn't fighting, Nazis and secret agents. So it was very odd. So that was in 1943. It was 15 chapters. I think it did fairly well for them. Actually, there's an interesting connection because Lewis Wilson, I believe, is the stepfather of one of the James Bond producers.
Okay.
It's Michael Wilson, I believe, is the producer. So there's an interesting connection there.
Was he a Brit?
From the film, it sounds like he's a Brit. Maybe they were trying to explain in the film that he was actually born in or raised in New England or something like that. But you can kind of detect a little bit in a couple of scenes. Alfred is in there, though. So Superman didn't make his live-action debut until 1948 with another 15-chapter serial starring Kirk Allen as Clark Kent Superman. Noel Neal as Lois Lane and former Little Rascals character actor Tommy Bond. He usually played the bad guy that was bullying Alfalfa and those. He was playing Jimmy Olsen in it. I can't recall the actor, but it had Perry White in it also. I'll think of him later. This was all about Superman coming to Earth. The first chapter is pretty much the origin story. He has to fight a villain in Metropolis. Again, not a comic book villain, but a costume villainess called the Spider Lady.
Oh, yeah.
And
who played her?
Carol Froman, I believe is her name. So she's all slinky.
I don't think I've ever seen the Superman serial. I've seen some of the Batman serial, and those are kind of lame. I mean, they don't hold up very well. I mean, Batman, his superpower is like he drives a car.
In the serial, it's just a regular sedan.
It's a Cadillac.
And they change in the back seat in a couple of the chapters, and it's funny the costume is so ill-fitting that when they get into a fight with the bad guy, immediately the cape goes in front of his outfit or falls off completely.
Yeah, but then it's back on in the next shot.
Was
it TCM show?
TCM
showed a couple of chapters the other night to give me a look at them.
I've got a couple on Super 8. Remember back in Famous Monsters of Filmland, though, when the Batman TV series was really at its peak and everybody had Batman mania, and the back Famous Monsters, they would say, buy Batman on Super 8 film. And I'm sure these kids probably thought they were going to get something with the Joker and the Penguin and the Catwoman, and they got these old 40 40s black and white films, and they're just like, what is this boring stuff where they sent me in the mail? I can imagine how disappointed these kids were.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting thing about the Superman serial, you would think that they would be using wires in order to lift Kirk Allen off the ground. No. Mm-hmm. As soon as he jumps into the air, he becomes an animated character. Jumping around, and you know, and so you've got this weird animated Superman, you know, rescuing people and zipping through the air, and it's very, very strange, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was in 1948. In 1949, Batman was back in a serial, another 15-chapter one, this time called Batman and Robin, with a different set of actors. It had Robert Lowery as Batman, and Johnny Duncan, who I think just passed away last year, the last few months, as Robin. And this also brought Vicki Vale to the big screen, who was playing by, I believe her name was Jane Addams. She plays the nurse assistant in House of Dracula.
Oh, yeah.
I remember her from that.
Hunchback.
Yeah, and matinee idol Lyle Talbot is playing Commissioner Gordon in this one. And they're not facing off against...
He was in Plan 9 from Outer Space.
That's right, that's right. Batman and Robin aren't facing off against one of their, you know, rogues gallery, but by that time it included the Penguin in the comics and I think Two-Face or, you know, people like that. Instead, it's a masked, cowled villain, a super scientist called the Wizard. And it's one of those standby plots of the serials that you never find out who exactly the Wizard is until the very end. And I think usually his voice is dubbed in by another actor to kind of throw you off, and it's part of the mystery of it. But in this one, the cowl and the cape are a little darker, but he's still having the same problem in the fight scenes with it, you know, getting in, you know, in the way of everything, and they're still changing in the back of a sedan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this one is pretty
Which
close
one's
to
the better,
original.
The 1949 or the 1943?
I think that if for laughs, the first one's a little funnier, even though some people may cringe at some of the racial slurs are hurled at Dr. Dacca at it.
And didn't they cut those out at one point?
They did. They overdubbed them, you know, at one point. So
but what, the ones they're showing on Turner, did they put those back in?
I think those are the original. But okay, I think most people know that the stuff played on Turner is representative of a time in history and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Even though people get huffy about it sometimes, you've got to show it intact.
Sure, sure. And then Superman.
Japanese lives matter.
And then in 1950, a year after Batman and Robin, Superman was back in the serials in Superman versus Atom Man, which is loosely based on a radio serial, a story arc in the radio
Kirk
show.
Allen as well.
Kirk Allen again Noel Neal, again Tommy Bond.
Perry
Watkins played Perry White in both of them, I should
say. Noel Neal is still with us, I believe.
She is. As I understand, she's living in Metropolis, Metropolis, Illinois. Yeah. But this one introduces Lex Luthor to the big screen, played by, again, Lyle Talbot.
Is that right? Was he bald?
He was bald, but when he's the Atom Man, he's wearing a big helmet, so there was a bit of a mystery as to whether Lex Luthor was Atom Man in the serial, but, you know, kids were watching and said, yeah, of course, Lex Luthor's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
This one does have Kirk Allen on some wires being hoisted above the studio floor, but they're still using quite a bit of the animation in it. Mm-hmm. So that was another big hit with the kids. Now, the same year, or later on in that year, DC decided they wanted to get into television, and they decided to produce a feature film, a sort of a pilot, sort of a test for their new TV show. So that was the reason that there is a feature called Superman and the Mole Man, starring George Reeves, and this time as Lois Lane, Phyllis Coates.
Phyllis Coates is also still with us.
Yes, yes, indeed.
That's
only about an hour or so long, and later on it was chopped into two episodes for the TV series.
And Beverly Washburn played the little girl in that, and she, of course, was in Spider Baby later on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Jerry Marin is in it, and a couple of the Billy Curtis.
So why was Kirk Allen replaced by George Reeves, do we know?
I don't know. I have a feeling that they wanted to set themselves apart from the serials. I think by that time, maybe Kirk was a concern about being typecast.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they said, well, we'll just go in a different direction. And of course, you know, typecasting is one of the problems that George Reeves ran into after that.
Mm-hmm. But Kirk Allen's career didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, he actually played another comic book hero soon after his last Superman one. He was Blackhawk, the ace pilot in the Blackhawk serial.
So and then there was the Superman TV show, of course. And then Superman didn't return on the big screen until the late 70s. Is that right?
That's right. This is after Batman was on the big screen with the 1966 Batman.
Oh, yeah. Now, that's my favorite.
Batman and Robin are fully deputized agents of the law. Support your police. That's our message.
Pretty fishy what happened to me on that ladder.
You mean where there's a fish, there could be a penguin.
But wait, it happened at sea. See? Sea for Catwoman.
An exploding shark was pulling my leg.
The Joker.
It all adds up to a sinister riddle. Riddler. Riddler?
That's my favorite Batman movie right there.
Yeah.
I've seen that. I mean, seriously. You got the Chris Nolan, Christian Bale trilogy. You got the 90s ones. And I've seen them all, but I've never gone back and watched any of those a second time. Where this 1966 Batman with Adam West and the gang, it's got a great script. Lorenzo Semple wrote that. I mean, he wrote Parallax View.
Three Days of the Condor.
He's a great writer. And the script is really, it's funny, but it's satirical and it's clever.
What weighs 6 ounces sits in a tree and is very dangerous.
A sparrow with a machine gun.
And they brought in, the whole rogues gallery. You had Joker, Penguin, Riddler, and Catwoman. And Julie Newmar was unavailable. Apparently, they filmed it between seasons 1 and 2 of Batman, so they brought in Lee Merriweather. Lee Merriweather's really, really good. She's not quite as sexy as Julie Newmar, but she's far, far better than that.
It's a little Eartha more believable, Kitt. The romance that she has going in her posing as this Russian newspaper reporter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, I always heard that they decided to make this film besides trying to capitalize on the TV show, but in order to afford the new Bat gadgets they wanted for the second season, because this film introduced the Bat boat and the Bat copter.
And the Bat plane.
The Bat cycle?
The Bat...
I know there's the copter. I don't think the plane is in there, but the Bat cycle is in there.
Okay. Yeah. There's a great scene where Batman's hanging from the copter and a shark is on his leg. And he says, Robin, hand me the Bat shark repellent.
And, of course, the scene that everyone talks about is him, Batman, running around the docks with the bomb above his head and saying, some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
Yeah. He's going to throw it off the dock and there's like ducks down there. Oh, he can't throw it at the ducks. So he's running around. Oh, that's a classic. I do love that movie. I've watched that movie many, many, many times.
It's a good standalone.
It is. It's amazing.
It's a good introduction to kids to the series, and then you can show them series afterwards. And then, as you're saying, it wasn't until 1978 when the Salkins and the other gentleman involved there, I'll think of it in a minute, but finally brought Superman back to the big screen. Mm-hmm. And Superman the movie.
God, look up there.
What the hell is that?
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me! Who's got you?
Yeah, that was an event, I tell you.
It was, and that was supposed to be one movie, and then they had to break it up into still the
Yeah, Richard Donner directed that.
Yeah, I think Spengler and the Salkins produced that, but they got into trouble for splitting up movies like that. They did that with the Three Musketeers, the Four Musketeers. But I remember, do you remember the ad line from that film? You will believe a man
can fly.
On the poster?
Yeah.
The special effects seemed so state-of-the-art at the time. They're a little quaint now. But they were great. And perfect casting with Mr. Christopher Reeve.
Yeah,
Marlon Brando.
Yeah, they tested and talked about casting every major male star in Hollywood, and I was like, go with an unknown. That was the best thing to do. But Christopher Reeve is so perfect as both Clark Kent and Superman.
He is.
And that sequence that everyone talks about with a big interview between Superman and Lois Lane, and then he comes back as Clark Kent to pick up Lois, and there's a moment when Clark is really debating whether he's going to tell Lois the secret. It's just a wonderful scene and perfectly acted by Christopher Reeve.
Great score, John Williams.
Iconic score.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
See, now I've seen that one many, many, many times. Mm-hmm. I don't think I saw any of the sequels more than once, but I've seen the original 78 version.
Yeah.
Just never gets old.
And of course, Superman then came back with part two in 1981, in which he faced off.
Wildly successful.
It was a big hit with the Kryptonian villains, but the director of the first one, Richard Donner, had been replaced by Richard Lester. So that was. Recently, in the last 5 years, they've come out with Richard Donner's cut of Superman 2.
It's not.
I think it's pretty good. I think that Niagara Falls sequence that Richard Donner did and the whole scene in the Daily Planet beforehand works very well. Yeah. But I think that a lot of Superman 2 is kind of goofy, you know, a lot of the slapstick stuff with. The
but not as goofy as Superman 3 and 4.
Yeah.
So,
that's true. Superman
Richard Pryor in.
Superman 3 kind of went off the rails. I did like the casting of Annette O'Toole as Lana Lang. I thought the scenes with her and Smallville worked.
But they didn't bring Gene Hackman back, and they sort of replaced him with Robert Vaughn.
Who's using Richard Pryor, who's a computer genius.
Yeah, Richard Pryor was very hot, I guess, around 1982 or 83, whenever that was made.
I remember when Superman 2 came out, Pryor was on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show talking about that. He said, oh, man, he's going to fight these Krypton. He was really excited about it. He was like a kid. Yeah. So I think the Salkin saw that and said, hey, you know, you want to be in this next one?
It's so hard to watch, though.
It is a tough one to watch.
You want
to
crawl out of your skin.
But then in 1988, they went even lower.
Yeah,
with
now we're talking.
Superman 4, The Quest for
Peace.
Mark Pillow is Nuclear Man. Yeah. They did bring back Gene Hackman, but instead of Miss Teschmacher or Otis, he had his nephew Lenny Luthor, played by John Cryer.
Oh, God.
And
that's right.
They had kind of an interesting subplot with the Daily Planet being taken over, and I think Clark's new editor was now Mariel Hemingway, who was very good.
And Superman gives a lot of speeches about nuclear weapons and. It's a message movie and not a very good one.
Yeah, for more about that film, we highly recommend Electric Boogaloo. They have a great sequence about that film.
All right, let's move on to when did Batman show up again?
1989.
And that's right, that was Tim Burton with the old Michael Keaton.
Oh, that
and
was
then
massive.
There was three sequels to that.
And then, oh my goodness.
1995, Batman Forever with
Batman
Val
Returns.
Kilmer.
Batman
Returns, then Batman Forever.
Batman Forever, and then Batman
Forever. I kind of like Batman Forever. Ooh. We saw Robin, we saw Jim Carrey as the Riddler. There's a lot to appreciate about that.
Well, it's certainly better than Batman and Robin, which is the absolute
pits. But wasn't Tommy Lee Jones Two-Face?
Yes.
He was.
And was Two-Face Harvey Dent?
But
Billy G. Williams was Harvey Dent in the first two.
Tim Burton film.
I like Chris.
I wonder why they replaced him with Jones. Maybe for box office.
I think so. Well, had Jones? He hadn't gotten his Oscar yet. I think when he did that.
But he did play Two-Face and Harvey Dent.
Yeah, he did. It did. And then the absolute, just the worst of the bunch is Batman and Robin, which is a complete goes off the rails.
Physically, George Clooney was a really good Batman. I think he had a stronger chin than Michael Keaton and Val Kilmer. I mean, but it was the script was horrible.
Yeah, well, Clooney gets a lot of heat for that, and finally said, no, it's a bad movie. I'm bad in it, but it's a bad movie. And it wouldn't have worked with anybody in it, even Michael Keaton. Hmm. It's just a terrible, terrible movie.
All right, we've got to move on because we're actually kind of running out of time. I didn't time this very well. What can we talk about next? I guess, does that bring us to Superman?
That brings us to the Nolan Batman.
Oh, that was before the...
Yeah, that Superman. Was Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises.
That series. Now, The Batman Begins, it was interesting because they brought in some sort of second-tier villains, and they have the Scarecrow and Ra's al Ghul or something.
Ra's al Ghul.
And they're from the comic book, I assume.
They are.
But they never showed up in the 60s TV series.
No, they were just in the animated versions up to that point. Yeah,
and Cillian Murphy was the Scarecrow.
That's right.
That was kind of cool, actually. Mm-hmm.
That was getting the series back on track. Yeah. That was what was necessary. Yeah, and then they came back with an even better film, which a lot of people consider the best superhero movie ever. It's in there.
It's not as good as the 1960s.
The Dark Knight.
And it won the Oscar, of course, for Heath Ledger's Joker.
Yeah, no, that was one of those things where when they cast him, I was like, why are they casting this pretty boy as the Joker? And then I saw it.
He showed
it worked. Yeah, he showed me. I was glad he did.
Yeah, and then that brings us to the third one in the series, which had Anne Hathaway as Catwoman, and who was the other? Oh, it was Bane. That's right.
Tom Hardy is Bane. Yeah. Huh. So just it's kind of
forgettable.
Yeah, it's kind of goofy. Some of the plot motivations are very strange in it.
And let's talk briefly about the Brandon Routh Superman. Do you like that one?
There are parts of that I kind of like.
I liked it, the nostalgia of it.
But he's a stalker at the end of it, and I hate that.
Yeah, I didn't like Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor. He just sat on his boat with Parker Posey and made a bunch of jokes.
Well,
like
you said, they could have brought in another villain.
Yeah, better villain.
Yeah, and there's no real comeuppance. I think he gets dropped off on an aisle at the end of it. I said, no, Superman should be bringing him to jail like he did with Gene Hackman at the end of the first one.
Well, Bryan Singer said, you know, he was such a huge Superman fan, and it became more of a passion project than an actual... Yeah. And he had his friends working on it, and he kind of needed to take a step back.
Yeah. And that brings us to the Superman movie, Man of Steel, from a couple of years ago, was okay, and then this new one, which opened over the weekend, which we have mixed feelings about. There will be more Batman and Superman movies long after we are gone. They will keep making them, and we will be around to review them as long as we are here. But we're going to have to wrap this up, unfortunately. But we will be back next week. We're going to review Demolition, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, and Everybody Wants Some, which is the new movie from Richard Linklater, and we'll be talking about all kinds of other stuff. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
Listen again next week.
Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather.
Oh, nutty steak. Hello, darling. Hey.
Black leather.